Hello and welcome to Viewpoints. I'm Boris Chassaigne. I'll be with you for the next half hour. On today's show, in Ontario, the Jukasa Six Nations recording studio adds 4 more Juno nominations to its list in 2023.
We're doing stuff on an international stage, all these different recordings and stuff that's like making a mark. Yeah. And it's all being done right here in Six Nations. So,
to Nova Scotia, where the RCMP continues to investigate mischief at the Liverpool Tourist Bureau. It was vandalized in January with various forms of anti-LGBTQ plus graffiti. Protesters at a drag queen story time event in Coquitlam, BC, wave homophobic signs and yell insults and slurs at attendees.
It started out with just like one person, and then it eventually grew to, there was probably maybe about 15 protesters outside. They were very agitated. They had signs with some vulgar words on them. There was also somebody who had a megaphone.
And the African Nova Scotian Justice Institute receives a provincial grant that will keep them in operation until March 2026.
Clearly, there's a need for some Black organization to be looking at what's happening in the human rights arena and to be following up on matters. The African Nova Scotian Justice Institute is an example of community-based innovation to address the systemic racism issues in this province.
Welcome to Viewpoints.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
We start the show in Nova Scotia, where the Queen's District RCMP continues to investigate mischief at the Liverpool Tourist Bureau. Between the evening of January 8 and the early morning hours of January 9, the Bureau was vandalized with various forms of anti-LGBTQ plus graffiti. Police have a photo of a person believed to be involved in the incident and a hint about the car and driver that could have been involved. In Liverpool, Nova Scotia, here's Ed Alverson.
Queen's District RCMP are continuing to investigate mischief at the Liverpool Tourist Bureau. Between the evening of January 8th and the early morning hours of January 9th, someone vandalized the building with various forms of graffiti. A photo of the person believed to be involved in the incident was released to the public in the hopes of identifying them. RCMP investigators have since learned that later that morning on January 9th, a dark-colored sedan with Ontario license plates parked at the Tourist Bureau. The driver exited the vehicle and met with another man who approached on foot. RCMP say the two people had a discussion, expressing the same hateful language that had been spray-painted on the Tourist Bureau. The driver of the vehicle is described as being in his early 20s with dark hair. The man who was on foot had a beard. Investigators say this act of mischief is consistent with being motivated by bias, prejudice, or hate against an identifiable group. A picture has been released and is available on our website. Anyone with information or dash cam footage for the area on January 10th is asked to contact the Queen's District RCMP or Crime Stoppers. I'm Ed Halverson.
Hello, I'm Andrew Dow in Six Nations Ontario. You are tuned in to Viewpoints. Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our stories online at canada-info.ca.
And we head out west where an LGBTQ plus event hosted by a local youth society has been protested once again in BC's Fraser Valley. A drag queen storytime event at the Coquitlam Public Library, held on January 14, was met with protesters. They waved homophobic signs and yelled insults and slurs at attendees. Samantha Wink, a spokeswoman for the Coquitlam Public Library, said the goal of the drag storytime event is to model inclusiveness, kindness and acceptance, as well as to promote a love of reading. The same week, founder of Action for Canada, Tana Ga, spoke at a Mission City Council meeting, asking what steps the city was taking to remove sexual orientation and gender identity, or SOGI 123, as well as comprehensive sexual education resources from the district. Action for Canada has been protesting drag story time since November of last year. In the summer of 2022, Fraser Valley Youth Society's Drag Storytime event was held in Abbotsford in collaboration with the Reach Gallery and was also protested. Co-executive director of the Fraser Valley Youth Society, Ali Slack, and drag time performer Frankie spoke with journalist Stephen Munga about the Storytime events and what's been happening in the Valley.
So how did the event come to be? Who were the people involved in putting the event together?
Fraser Valley Pride runs as a fundraiser for Fraser Valley Youth Society, which is a 2S LGBTQ plus youth organization. Part of Fraser Valley Pride is not just having one day of events, but trying to bring together community partners and community members and put on different events for Abbotsford and for the Fraser Valley. And so we were working with the Reach Art Gallery in putting together some kind of event that promotes inclusivity and diversity for 2S LGBTQ plus youth and families and children. And what came to be in conversations with the Reach and with Fraser Valley Pride is hosting a drag story time event, which would bring kind of our community together to share culture and that piece of drag and inclusivity, but also be able to read books to families and just kind of share and also invite people into another safe space like the Reach.
So on that day, myself and three other performers had arrived early at the Reach Gallery. And when we had arrived, there were no protesters outside. So everything seemed like pretty normal. It seemed like this would be a really like kind of regular event. I think probably about maybe 15 minutes before the event started, protesters started showing up. And I got a text message, protesters are here. And I'm like, oh, okay. It started out with just like one person. And then it eventually grew to, there was probably maybe about 15 protesters outside. It escalated quite quickly and they were very agitated. They had signs with some vulgar words on them. There was also somebody who had a megaphone who was shouting out slurs and hate speech on this megaphone. And the staff at the Reach responded quite quickly. They were asked to leave, which they did not comply with. And then the Reach pretty quickly like closed all the blinds so that you couldn't see them from the outside.
Inside.
And also to staff from FBYS and from the Reach were redirecting families to a back entrance.
People were having to be snuck in pretty much because there was so much commotion in the front. At some point, police did show up. Do you have a take on if the police should have done more, or do you think that they did exactly what they should have?
So I was the one who called police at the event, or at least the first one to do so. We had one officer show up and were told that it was a difference of opinion. So there wasn't really much that could be done in terms of allowing both people to kind of share their opinions or their views. I think a lot of people were caught off guard with what happened. We hadn't pre-prepared for any protest or kind of any backlash for having this event. And so we hadn't spoken with the police in advance. We hadn't really planned out what would be done. So I want to be conscious of that too. I think going into the next year, our hope can be that we are more prepared and that others who might be attending the event, which includes police, but also just includes anyone who's attending, can kind of know what's happening and think about ways to better diffuse the situation, but also protect the community from hate speech. For our Fraser Valley Pride event itself, the festival in the park, we were prepared for it. We had conversations ahead of time and we knew what was going on in other communities. But when thinking about like a children and family event, when thinking about the fact that the books we were reading were specifically made for children and maybe introduce a child with same-sex parents, we weren't expecting any backlash for that event. Yeah, it's definitely a case of looking back, okay, what do we need to do differently? Because something that we would take for granted as just a safe space and a really innocent event was being perceived differently.
What are your thoughts on like the city of Abbotsford when it comes to like marginalized groups?
I think that there's always opportunity and room for education and inclusivity training. You know, it's awesome to have a great EDI policy, but unless it's backed with action, I can see how those feelings of not feeling safe, you know, are there and present.
There was a lot of disinformation being spread about what drag is, about what 2S LGBTQ plus community is and what our organizations do. Because at the heart of it, we exist to support 2S LGBTQ youth and families, but also just all queer and trans people in our community and really create safety for that. So for example, Fraser Valley Youth Society has drop-ins for youth. We're just trying to create a place where youth are connected to others, where they are able to share, where they're able to get resources they're in need of. And what people who were, I guess, quote unquote, protesting the event, they were hearing misinformation on alternate news sites that event was associated with child grooming or with pedophilia. And at the heart of kind of what their beliefs are, I think it reminds me of like the abortion conversation so much too, in that we're just have different differing opinions on like what is actually the issue at hand here, or what is it. And so we also think child grooming and all these things are terrible, and we're trying to protect our young people and we're trying to protect families. But that's not what queer and trans identities are about. It's about making sure our youth feel comfortable in their bodies and they have safety and they have someone they can talk to.
Hi, I'm Sarah Gouda in Halifax, Nova Scotia. You are tuned to Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories online at canada-info.ca and follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI.
Six Nations-based Jukasa Recording Studio is involved in the production of albums recently nominated for 4 Juno Awards in the Rock Album of the Year category, Blues Album of the Year, as well as for Best Contemporary Roots Album. Jukasa's head engineer and studio manager Darren Majerowski and second engineer Jill Zimmerman are thrilled by the nominations. They give credit to the studio's achievements, to the person whose vision it was to build it in the first place, Six Nations entrepreneur Kenny Hill, who passed away in January 2021. The studio, opened in 2009, has over the years engineered recordings that have received 14 Juno nominations, as well as 3 Juno Awards. More with David Moses in Oshawakin, Ontario.
Six Nations-based Jukasa Recording Studios has 4 nominations in the just-announced 2023 Junos. Best Rock Album nominations include Alexis on Fire for Otherness, Today's Grace for their album Explosions, which were both recorded at Jukasa, and in addition, the renowned studio recorded 2 other Juno-nominated records, one for Best Blues Album by Hamilton artist Harrison Kennedy, entitled Thanks for Tomorrow.
I got the wine, I got the time.
As well as Best Contemporary Roots Album by Blackie and the Rodeo Kings for their release, Old Glory. That album, of course, features Lee Harvey Osmond, more commonly known as the Indigenous singer-songwriter Tom Wilson. The 2 engineers behind all these records are head engineer and studio manager Darren Majerowski and second engineer Jill Zimmerman. Although many rock bands have recorded at the studio, both Darren and Jill are open to working with any and all music and artists.
We definitely don't cater to any genre, because we've done like everything under the sun. I just think that maybe we've had more rock bands come here because of the layout of the floor, where everyone can like record live off the floor, like drums, guitars, vocals, all that kind of stuff. And that's why we've had like, you know, a few blues bands as well, because it's really outfitted for like band recording a lot. So it seems to attract a lot more rock bands, and that's maybe why we've had more nominations maybe in the rock category. But we definitely don't cater to like a genre. Like, everybody's welcome, and we've done pretty much everything I can think of.
Well, yeah, that's why it's also 3 different categories that the studio has nominations in, because it's not just the one genre. It's also blues, it's contemporary roots, it's, you know, we have a lot of Indigenous nominations generally, and it's just, it's whatever happens, whatever comes our way.
Yeah, I'd like to be like to get like records in as many different categories as possible, because like I've never wanted to be like a niche engineer where it's like, oh, he's just a rock guy. No, I want to do hip hop. I want to do country. I want to do blues. I want to do jazz. We've got a big jazz record coming up in a week.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So like, you know, like I'd like to, spread it out as much as possible. I don't ever want to be like genre specific. So,
because good music is good music.
Yeah.
But they give direct credit of the studio's achievements to the person whose vision it was to build it, Six Nations entrepreneur Kenny Hill, who passed away in January of 2021.
Well, first and foremost, like, he was just a builder of things in general, right? Mm. Like his legacy, like, I mean, you know, the amount of different businesses that he built.
Yeah.
Like, he couldn't stop. Right. To the day that he passed, he couldn't stop building things. And it was like, I think one of the root things is because of his eldest son, Josh, was an aspiring musician.
Mm.
And he was traveling to Atlanta on a regular basis to use some of the studios down in Atlanta. And so Kenny went with him one of the times and saw one of the studios in Atlanta, and he went, holy shit, this is really nice. You know what I mean? Mm. And then a light bulb went off and went, I should make one of these. Hey, Josh, then you don't need to go to Atlanta. Like, let's just make one right here at home, right? Because he could, right? So I think that was one of the things that kind of sparked the fire, is that he kind of got inspired by this thing and went, wait a minute, how about I just make one? And then obviously it's going to benefit the community.
Yep.
And when you think about the amount of like world-class musicians that have come out to Six Nations.
Absolutely.
And that we're doing stuff on an international stage, like all these different recordings and, you know, Juno nominated records, and we have, you know, a pile of gold records now. And, we've been a part of 4 number one hits in the United States. Like, there's some heavy duty, like, stuff that's like making a mark, and it's all being done right here in Six Nations. So
I think another reason why he invested so much money is Kenny doesn't half ass things. He never did. He doesn't do that. Like, the golf course is immaculate. It's like even the gym is way bigger than it probably needs to be, but you know what? It has all the top of the line equipment.
Yes.
And he does that for all his businesses.
Yep.
I mean, for Josh, because he was mainly a rapper, he could have made a way smaller studio.
Sure.
With way less gear
and
way cheaper.
Right.
But that's not who Kenny was.
Right.
He always went all in and tried to get the best out of it.
The studio opened in 2009 and has received 14 Juno nominations, as well as 3 Junos. One for the Sheepdogs release in 2012, another for Harrison Kennedy in 2016, and the third for July Talk in 2017. The 52nd Annual Juno Awards will take place in Edmonton on March 13th. I'm David Moses.
Smithers, BC, and you are listening to Viewpoints.
The African Nova Scotian Justice Institute received $4.8 million in funding from the former Liberal government in July of 2021. A year later, Premier Tim Houston announced an additional $4.1 million in funding for March of 2024 until March 2026. The vast majority of the funding received will be utilized towards staffing. The Institute's mandate is to serve the African Nova Scotian community and communities of people of African descent throughout Nova Scotia in the field of direct legal service delivery, strategic justice, and forensic assessment and treatment. The Institute is also involved in human rights issues and overseeing the work of the police, such as monitoring street checks. Sarah Gouda is in Halifax, Nova Scotia. She spoke with Robert Wright, interim director of the Nova Scotia Justice Institute, about the role the organization intends to play over the next few years.
The Institute itself has a mandate to really be serving the African Nova Scotian community and the communities of people of African descent throughout Nova Scotia in the field of justice. Like most nonprofits, the vast majority of the funding that we receive is related specifically to staffing, for the various things that we would set out to do. So The African Nova Scotian Justice Institute really provides, we envision ourselves providing services in three different areas. Direct legal service delivery in what we call strategic justice initiatives and in forensic assessment and treatment. Those are the three main pillars of the organization. Within the Justice Institute, we actually operate a nonprofit law firm that provides free legal services to African Nova Scotians and other people of African descent across Nova Scotia. You know, we already have a Nova Scotia legal aid system, so it's not like every Black person who needs a lawyer will come to the Justice Institute, but there may be particular cases where individuals either are not eligible for legal aid, but that their issues are relevant to justice-seeking issues in the African Nova Scotian and Black communities generally, that would suggest it would be important for the Justice Institute to take on that case. And we are certainly developing expertise in that area of critical race adjudication or legal work, so that we have a very particular African Nova Scotian and Black lens on some of that work. So that's an expertise that we can lend to other organizations. So if a Black person actually has a lawyer, but that lawyer doesn't have that expertise, then they can consult with the Justice Institute around some of those things. In that legal pillar, though, we also see that we have a mandate to do some human rights and policing oversight work. You can imagine, for example, that street checks is an example of the kind of activity that police have undertaken historically that has had a negative and dramatic impact on the Black community. Well, the Justice Institute is there as an arm, as you will, of the Black community to bring legal recourse to those kinds of issues. And also in terms of human rights. In the 2003 human rights case that was won by Kirk Johnson, for example, is the matter that brought street checks clearly into focus. Much of the work that was supposed to be done in that case was left undone until 2019. Clearly, there's a need for some Black organization to be looking at what's happening in the human rights arena and to be following up on matters to ensure that even when people of African descent in Nova Scotia win their human rights cases, that the kinds of remedies that are recommended or mandated by the Human Rights Commission are actually completed and carried out.
Sorry, can I just, Robert, for our audience members who are not familiar with the Kirk Johnson case, can you just give a brief summary about it?
Well, Kirk Johnson is an African Nova Scotian who was a world-class heavyweight boxer who, when he visited home in way back then, he was repeatedly pulled over by police. And he said, well, you're pulling me over because I'm Black. And he launched a human rights complaint against the police. The Human Rights Commission said, yes, indeed, it seems that the policing that was done here in this case was racially motivated. So the police were ordered to keep track of their race-based statistics, and they were also ordered to conduct an academic study of this matter, but they never did do an academic study until 2019, when, as a result of FOI-popping the race-based stats that the police were keeping, the whole issue came back into focus.
Thank you for that, Robert. I wanted to speak a little bit about how you help a client get legal aid. Can you discuss the process? What kind of cases are you focusing on?
Legal aid is a pretty straightforward process. A person who has a legal problem can apply for legal aid. And if they reach the eligibility criteria, they get legal aid from Nova Scotia Legal Aid. But sometimes either individuals are unable to receive support from legal aid because they are not eligible, or there might be some kind of conflict there. In those cases, the Justice Institute is available to provide direct legal support to individuals who may need legal support if those issues fall within our mandate. And our mandate is, of course, pursuing justice for people in the Black communities here in Nova Scotia.
And what kind of cases does the Institute focus on?
Well, there are a lot of criminal justice cases, so people who are charged under the Canadian Criminal Code. There are some employment cases, so people who are feeling unjustly treated on the job. There are certainly some human rights cases that we're tracking and following as well. And then there are our appeal cases, and these are cases that perhaps might have been criminal cases that were heard and adjudicated at the lower court level that perhaps are being appealed to the Nova Scotia Court of Appeal because of some of a race-based issue. So, but I should say that the work that African Nova Scotians have been doing around access to justice issues, that work has been going on for about as long as there have been African Nova Scotians. You know, that work has been going on for a very long time. You know, the African Nova Scotian Justice Institute is an example of community-based innovation to address the systemic racism issues in this province. I would encourage people who are at DAL to think about the ways in which they might be able to support or contribute. So we're always looking for ways in which our work can complement and support the other work that is happening, not just on behalf of people of African descent, but all equity-seeking and justice-seeking peoples.
That's all for us at Viewpoints. Thanks to our journalists this week, Ed Halverson, David Moses, Sarah Gouda, and Stephen Munga. National editor Maureen McEwen. Viewpoints is produced by the Community Radio Fund of Canada. At Viewpoints, we produce local news nationwide, and you can find tons of stories from all across the country at canada-info.ca. Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassaigne. Great to have you with us. Until next week, ciao.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.